Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
One of the challenges that Australia has now is facing a choice between whether or not we want China to be a factor behind why we would engage and how we would engage in the region, or whether it bleeds into being the entire justification for why we would engage in aid and development.
Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, they don't want to choose. They don't want to choose between Australia and China. They don't want to choose between US and China. They want to be their own sovereign country that is benefiting the most from whatever is on the table.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, CEO of the Development Intelligence Lab, Bridie Rice, and Senior Fellow at the International Security Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Errol Yabuke, join Policy Director at the ANU National Security College, Dr. William Stoltz, to discuss the intersection of security and development issues in the Pacific region. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
Bridie, Errol, thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Will. Great to be here.
Thanks, Will.
So you've both worked and researched extensively across issues at the intersection of development, conflict mitigation, and security. These themes have become pretty topical for Australian policymakers and US policymakers recently, not least of all because of events in the Pacific. So I think this is going to be a really timely conversation. But I want to start first on, I guess, the intersection between development assistance and conflict mitigation. Errol, the United States is obviously, you know, it's an enormous provider of aid and economic assistance for developing and fragile countries around the world. So I understand there's been some significant changes in how the United States approaches this task, namely in the form of the Global Fragility Act. I think I'm getting that right. So perhaps you can start us off by explaining what the Fragility Act is, and perhaps how it's seeking to change America's previous approach to things like conflict mitigation.
Sure. Yeah. Thanks, Will, and thanks again for having me on. I like how you said it's the United States is trying a new approach here, because I think that's what this is, both in terms of its trying nature and the fact that this is a really focused on process and changing the way that the US government thinks about tough places. It's not necessarily opening up unlimited amounts of cash to throw at a problem in places experiencing fragility. In 2019, the US Congress passed the Global Fragility Act. It was signed into law by then President Trump, and with bipartisan support, deep support from Republicans and Democrats, which continues today. The Biden administration recently sort of jump-started the implementation of this by launching what we call in shorthand the Global Fragility Strategy. It's got a longer name that includes words like peace and stability and things like that. But it's really meant to be a blueprint at the 30,000-foot level of what the U.S. can and perhaps should be doing in places experiencing fragility. Now, the most eagerly awaited part of this was where they were going to try to do this first. And it's important to say right off the bat that this is meant to be changing the way that the U.S. government approaches these issues, primarily, and Australians will understand this, primarily by making sure that the left hand is talking to the right hand within government. And those hands are talking to the feet and they're talking to the heads. And just everybody's playing in the interagency sandbox a little bit better than we have in the past. And so of course, you can't start with, you know, all the places around the world that are tough and require stabilization and you know, it can be classified in some way as fragile. And so they had to pick some places. And so the five areas that they've picked are coastal West Africa, Libya, Mozambique, Haiti, and I think most relevant to your Australian audience, Papua New Guinea.
Mm. No, it's a fascinating and probably quite a prudent way to undertake it. Bridie, I'm interested in your views as someone, you know, who's studied various different approaches to development assistance, and you're currently in DC at the moment, so you've probably got a good perspective on these things. You know, American power and responsibilities around the world are pretty stretched at the moment, and I think that's probably reflected in what Errol's describing there about this need to kind of triage where they focus. So, you know, how hopeful do you think we can be that the US can kind of implement this more sophisticated approach to development for conflict mitigation?
Yeah, well, it's definitely a question that is on the minds of a lot of the people I'm chatting to here in Washington, but also in Port Moresby as well. I think there's something really exciting about the ambition of the Global Fragility Strategy, and it's something I've been looking at over the last couple of years as it's been developing, because for us in Australia, this is the most ambitious attempt to be serious about that all tools of statecraft rhetoric that we've been hearing, certainly out of the coalition, but also out of our Labor government at home as well. And when we're saying all tools of statecraft, I can't think of another piece of foreign policy that is attempting to bring those tools together, as Errol's saying, get people talking to each other, make sure the right hand knows what the left hand is doing. Other than this. So I guess on the one hand, I'm hearing excitement. I'm hearing planning teams being sent into Port Moresby. I'm hearing interagency roundtables that are properly trying to discuss not just what can development bring to the table, but what can a defence force do when it comes to fragility? What can the State Department do? What can our diplomats do? And really trying to harness the best of each of those to make more than the sum of its parts. So I guess that's the optimistic view. And from the Canberra perspective, I'm watching this very, very closely because, of course, the rubber will hit the road on its implementation in Papua New Guinea. But I'm also hearing the typical response that, you know, any bureaucrat would give you when a brand new piece of legislation and a massive strategy and a whole heap of political weight is put behind something. And that is, oh, a bit of a sigh, a bit of a, oh, it might just be another piece of paper. Let's see how it goes. So I'm completely going to hedge my bets on this one, Will, and say, on the one hand, this is exciting, but we know from the UK, we know from the US, we know from Australia just how hard it is to genuinely coordinate agencies. And in a place where the US has less experience, like Papua New Guinea, I don't think we can overestimate those challenges. So I'm excited, but I think the jury's out on how this would work. And I think the US knows that. They're taking their time on this planning.
Will, I've got a, if you'll indulge me, I've got another poor analogy here. And it's essentially the US government has been oriented towards response. When something happens, we respond. And quite frankly, we respond with force better than any country in the world. And we've certainly embedded civilians with that response. I've myself worked in Iraq and Afghanistan and South Sudan and Ethiopia and Somalia and some other places. And I think what this is trying to do, I would agree with everything Bridie is saying. I think the other thing that you hear from diplomats is what this is trying to do is you're not going to prevent conflict over a 10-year period that this Global Fragility Strategy is meant to be implemented over a 10-year period. And you're not going to prevent conflict in all of those places. You may get the interagency to talk to each other better, but, and here's where the analogy comes in. Essentially, you've had a super tanker or, you know, a massive aircraft carrier that's sort of pointed towards responding. And then you've got this tiny little tugboat that is the Global Fragility Act, that's trying to slowly but surely and very earnestly kind of reorient us a little bit more towards a posture of conflict prevention. And I think that's really the goal over the next 10 years. It sounds ridiculous almost that that is what we're hoping to accomplish in 10 years. But as people who have worked in and around government know, these things take time, you know, and we need to develop new muscles. And that's what this is meant to do.
Errol, you're spot on this. I mean, at a macro level, what we're seeing from the US government is a recognition that only responding or marshalling all forces in response is no longer going to cut it. And I feel as though after Afghanistan, Iraq, all the reflections that have gone on, with it has come a renewed sense that we need to work longer, harder, and across longer time horizons as well if we actually want to prevent the sort of fragility that ultimately becomes conflict. And for Australia, I think this is really interesting because in a lot of aid agencies or a lot of foreign policy establishments in the UK and the US, you can almost carve up your international assistance amongst a few buckets. And of course, this is a complete oversimplification, but you sort of have your classic development assistance, right? Health, education, inclusive economic development. You've then got your humanitarian responders, right? A crisis happens, we come in and respond. We've got stabilization missions, you know, in Australia, think East Timor, think the Solomon Islands as well. But in the UK and the US, you have something else, and it's this big bucket and of amazing thinkers and practitioners who walk across government in, I guess, that conflict prevention or that stability or that peace building frame of mind. And in Australia actually used to lead the World Bank Working Group on fragility. I think we managed to poach some of the best of the best from the UK to work on conflict prevention and fragility. And this work takes not just boots on the ground and smart boots on the ground, but it takes a hell of a lot of analysis to work out what are the drivers of fragility and conflict. And in recent times, we've stepped away from that type of work in Australia. And so what we have in Canberra is largely a community of amazing development practitioners and policymakers. We've got strong humanitarian response, stabilization maybe if we need it, though not on a scale that the US has. But really, we don't talk about Papua New Guinea as a fragile country. We don't have a fragility strategy. We don't necessarily even have a conflict prevention strategy either. So this is a really big difference between how the US is coming into Papua New Guinea and how Australia is looking at the region and how we marshal our attention towards things like conflict prevention.
So it sounds like there's potentially some lessons to be learned or observed as the United States rolls out this new approach. Certainly this idea of like greater agency, interagency cooperation and a kind of more joint approach does tend to strike me that perhaps that might be a bit easier to achieve in the Australian context, given it's a much smaller system. But I suppose we'll see how the Americans go first with it. So I'm interested to kind of focus on the events in this region and to really get your response, I suppose, to you know, the dominating kind of strategic focus, which is China's kind of counter development proposal, so to speak, and the kind of all consuming way that great power competition can kind of dominate these discussions. Are you concerned that the focus on China and geostrategic competition is perhaps like sucking the oxygen out of other important challenges to the peaceful development of so-called fragile states? Or perhaps alternatively, is it actually making policymakers kind of more alive to the urgency of development and conflict mitigation and the need to put in long-term strategies? So I'm thinking perhaps, for example, this new initiative, this Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity that was launched a couple of weeks ago, you know, that perhaps may not have come about if it wasn't for the focus on the kind of great power geopolitical competition. Errol, I'm interested in perhaps your response to that proposition.
Yeah, in the United States, with a lot of these issues, you cannot take politics out of the equation. I think when it comes to implementing policy, you can sometimes take politics out. But I think with something like a 10-year strategy, you have to keep Congress engaged, and therefore you have to have different angles through which to address some of these big challenges. And it's became clear during the Trump administration that a risen China or competition with a risen China was the entry point for most Republicans to be engaged and interested and worried about issues of foreign policy. And I think you saw some things like the Global Fragility Act. It wasn't solely because of China. I think it's largely the Global Fragility Act got passed, I think, in large part because of years and years and years of advocacy by the peacebuilding community that resulted in significant education on Capitol Hill of members of Congress of saying, look, we need to reorient this supertanker. We need this tugboat. But I think one of the things that helped it get over the finish line was geostrategic competition with China and the fact that China is not just competing, but oftentimes the only game in town in a lot of these places. And so when it comes to the selection of the countries, look, you can ask U.S. government officials how these countries were selected. And I get lots of people asking, like, why Papua New Guinea? Why Mozambique, et cetera? We'll never know the full answer. My educated guess is that China's increasing interest in the Pacific Islands was not an insignificant factor in the selection of Papua New Guinea. I think the presence of Australia's largest overseas mission is in Papua New Guinea. It's larger than Washington. It's larger than Jakarta. And I think that was not an insignificant factor. I think we have a close and getting closer by the day relationship with Australia. And I think the fact that y'all were there played a pretty big role in this. So I would say China is a factor here. I don't think it's necessarily the only driving force anymore. But as I don't know Australian politics as well as I know US politics, but things here, messaging can kind of change depending on who's pulling the levers of power.
Errol, that's a really interesting point that you describe, because it's something that has struck me 3 weeks into Washington attending all these meetings and roundtables, that it feels as though that China factor that you talk about, getting the strategy over the line, is a factor but is not the reason for being behind, for example, US aid and development work or conflict prevention work like this. I think, Will, your question really boils down to, you know, has China made this type of work more relevant? And, you know, having gone through the last couple of elections in Australia, I can tell you being an aid and development advisor or a strategist is not a popular kind of job. And yet this time coming into the election, of course, as the Solomon Islands deal broke out, of course, as things got hot, absolutely. This notion that Australia needed to step into the region to support the development aspirations of our neighbours, or they might go looking elsewhere, crystallised in the most powerful way. But I think one of the challenges that Australia has now is facing a choice between whether or not we want China to be a factor behind why we would engage and how we would engage in the region, or whether it bleeds into being the reason or I guess the entire justification for why we would engage in aid and development. And I think that is a dangerous piece of the strategic pie that Australia really needs to sort out and can sort out in a new development strategy process. But I think that the US is a little more clear-headed. Whether or not Australia would take the same position is up for grabs. But the US is very, very clear-headed about how it will use its aid program vis-a-vis China. And it is all about fostering the kind of open societies and resilience and free media and shining the light on coercion and corruption and governance and fragility that we're talking about here, as a way to offer countries a choice, would be the current language. That is, for example, very different to a choice facing other countries or in Australia too, about competing on the basis of infrastructure or playing whack-a-mole when something goes wrong and being reactive. So I think that there's a lot of work for Australia to do in that space, but I think I'm quite confident that that is happening in the halls of Canberra, but it's certainly not a well-informed public debate at the moment.
We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Just to kind of stay on that proposition of the choice that faces Pacific countries and to, you know, stay on this topic of China's engagement with the Pacific, you know, we saw during Foreign Minister Wang Yi's recent tour of the region, the kind of presentation by China of a comprehensive plan for development and security assistance at a kind of whole of region level, you know, and the issues around that are probably fairly intuitive to most of us, most of those people listening. But to kind of play devil's advocate for a moment, and particularly from the perspective of the Pacific Island countries that we're talking about and the development objectives we're talking about, why is China's plan a bad thing? You know, in the absence of clear alternatives, why not sign up to these propositions? You know, if only the United States is only just now kind of coming around to taking a kind of whole of nation approach to these things, and Australia is kind of still lagging. If you're a Pacific Island country leader, why not sign up to a comprehensive proposition like this if you're trying to achieve the kind of development objectives that we're talking about?
Yeah, I think this is an excellent question. And I, when Bridie used the word choice, your listeners can't see me cringe because they're listening to this, not watching me, but they're was a framework that was being tossed around during the Trump administration here in the United States that was a clear choice. And U.S. Agency for International Development used this a lot. You know, there's a clear choice between us and some boogeyman somewhere else that, of course, was China. And I think what you're seeing is a lot more nuanced of an approach by the Biden administration. They would never come out and say, China is the reason that we're in Papua New Guinea and, you know, we're interested in anti-corruption because it's a counter to China, etc. I think the reason that you have this more nuanced tone is because one of the things that we learned during the Trump administration, and a lot of U.S. government officials that are in political positions now were outside at think tanks like mine, and we're sort of listening to all of these countries bristle at the idea of clear choice. They don't want to choose. Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, they don't want to choose. They don't want to choose between Australia and China. They don't want to choose between US and China. They want to be their own sovereign country that is benefiting the most from whatever is on the table. I think for us, us meaning the United States, and I won't speak on behalf of Australia, but for us, it is, we didn't want China to be the only game in town. Because if you're a developing country, say a Pacific Island nation or whatever, and you have a choice between Chinese investment that comes with strings attached, perhaps even authoritarian strings attached, and nothing, you're going to take that development with strings, right? And so we are trying to present a choice without actually forcing people to make a choice and using perhaps a little bit more carrots than sticks. Now, we're talking more broadly about development here rather than just sort of fragility and stabilization and things, but I think that's it, part of what is happening here in the United States, and perhaps that's something that Australia can learn from as well, because and I'm sure the Australian diplomats are hearing this as much as the US diplomats are, like, don't make us choose. You know, we're not going to come out and say anything bad about China because we need their roads and bridges as much as we need your, you know, financial investment and your companies to come and invest and, you know, the extractive industries to do their thing.
Hmm. Well, I think that question, you know, why not sign up is the right one. And I'm not always convinced that we've had the humility to ask ourselves or really listen as to why. So even, for example, the recent economic framework partnership that was signed, what we know from a lot of the countries in the Indo-Pacific around what they were after was actually market access to the US. That hasn't been forthcoming in that framework. Similarly, when I go and speak to colleagues in Papua New Guinea about the China proposition, quite often they'll say things to me around the ideology of the China engagement. It is a South-South positioning. It is a, we are like you. We have suffered colonialism like you. We understand like you that we would like to improve our own future as well. These are very, very different starting points to where aid and development in places like Australia or the United States have really come from. So I think that question around, you know, why shouldn't countries sign up? Why wouldn't they? What happens if they do? And then what is the value proposition of Australia in these countries requires a little bit of soul searching. And that's hard, right? We're talking about rapid budget cycles, rapid decisions. I think Richard Maud recently described Australia drinking its foreign policy challenges out of a fire hose. You know, we're not in a perfect world making these calls at all. So I don't think it's as simple as, hey, just listen a little more to the Pacific. I think there's got to be some seriously deep analysis around what the opportunities and the drivers of development are in the Pacific. And good, honest look at what Australia should offer, because at the moment we're kind of trying to offer everything. We're there on health, we're there on education, we're there on infrastructure, we're suddenly there on direct budget support, we're there on jobs and all the rest of it. I hope that all these pilots that are flourishing at the moment have some good metrics about them, because otherwise, Will, we're not going to answer your question. Why not sign up to China? Why sign up to ours?
Well, to kind of drill down, I suppose, you know, we've been speaking in general terms about the development challenges facing the Pacific, but perhaps to go a little bit more specifically, you know, Errol, you mentioned the Fragility Act kind of has a 10-year kind of strategic perspective of when it wants to achieve its goals. I mean, what actually are the development challenges that we should be prioritizing and focusing on the most when it comes to, I suppose, the Pacific region generally, but perhaps in particular, the, you know, PNG, which is the largest by population country in the Pacific region?
I'll answer that by saying what I think is going to happen, and then by saying what I think should be happening. And those aren't necessarily the same things on every account. So what I think will happen is that Papua New Guinea has an unfortunate history and current reality of violence against women, great amounts of gender inequality. The more I research Papua New Guinea, the more I realize that this is a fundamental barrier to not only economic growth, but also sort of contributor to state fragility. As a quick aside, I almost never use the term fragile state, because if you experienced the January 6th insurrection in the United States, you might call us a fragile state. So I think elements of fragility that involve the state are present in almost every country. I would argue in both of our countries as well. And I think that's true for Papua New Guinea. It may exist more places, but there's probably some elements of stability. So aside from the aside, I think the US government is going to focus on this gender-based violence thing because it's an issue, but also because we kind of know what to do with that. We've done a lot of that programming around the world. And when we involve ourselves in things like development and humanitarian aid and stabilization, it's very project-based. It's very like, what do we do? You know, who do we fund? And what are those people going to do? And I think that is probably where we're headed with this. Now, what I think should happen and is not necessarily incongruous with what I just said, but Papua New Guinea has a severe crisis of governance, it seems, and there's an election coming up. And it remains to be seen not only what the outcome of that is, but whether that outcome is going to be accepted by folks and what the reaction to that outcome is going to be. There are several breakaway regions, at least one of which could be an independent country in the not so distant future, at least try to become an independent country. And so there's these sort of fundamental issues of governance and sort of government capacity and state fragility that exist. And the US is not coming in with a whole, you know, treasure chest of money. Australian investment in terms of dollars is going to far dwarf the United States investment for the foreseeable future, if not forever, in Papua New Guinea. But the United States does come in with some clout on and sort of ability to flex its diplomatic muscles, both in the multilateral system, sort of bring Papua New Guinea into the fold in the international system, but also just, you know, on anti-corruption, on good governance, on, you know, simple things like let's get three bids when there's a construction project going on, things like that. I think we're very good at that. And I think those are kind of the muscles that we need to bring to Papua New Guinea as well, because there are some pretty fundamental governance challenges that don't seem to be getting any better and could, by what I understand, get a little bit worse.
Errol and I are certainly singing from the same song sheet on this one. I spent a number of years very, very luckily working inside the Papua New Guinean Department of Justice with an amazing group of reformers there. And in that time, it became very clear to me that you could throw all the projects, all the funding, all the bright ideas, all the amazing legislation and policy at Port Moresby that you wanted. But if you did not attempt to tackle the fact that anywhere between $300 and $400 million is ripped out of that economy every year, this is money that should be going to health and education. This is money that should be going to gender-based violence. Heck, this is money that should be going to a police force to help it manage its own elections as well. If you can't tackle that systemic problem in a place like Papua New Guinea, then I'm not sure how you would ever go around, you know, developing a high impact project in one particular province, right? So this meta crisis of corruption, of governance, of statehood in Papua New Guinea, I think is something that we sometimes both catastrophize, but also don't take seriously when it comes to working out how to support. And I think there are a couple of exciting signs very early in the US approach on Papua New Guinea. One is that they're not being completely blinkered by Port Moresby, right? Papua New Guineans are saying, get out of the capital, see our country, learn about us, sit with us in the village and see what really makes this country tick, because it's not just the institutions you see in Port Moresby. There's all sorts of informal power dynamics. I think the other one is that this piece of foreign policy has the opportunity to force these agencies to come to the table and see what they can offer. And on corruption, the US risk appetite when it comes to anti-money laundering and asset recovery, these are the technical ways that you try and recover that $300 and $400 million that, by the way, doesn't always stay in Papua New Guinea. It might be flying around New York or Cairns or Sydney or Manila or Hong Kong. This sophisticated transnational way that places like the US invest in anti-money laundering, asset recovery, anti-corruption work. Similarly, again, how they invest in investigative journalism and the sorts of things that shine a light on corruption. I think that's an exciting opportunity that a lot of reformist and emerging leaders in Papua New Guinea would welcome from the US. They would welcome that classic opening up of civic space. And I think from Australia's perspective, it would be nice to have the US in there as well, because sometimes bilaterally it's tricky to tackle those gnarly issues of corruption, and working in partnership with places like the US is just smart policy for everyone. So I think there's some really exciting subnational stuff that'll come out of this, and there is no doubt that gender inequality is a major driver of fragility. And we also know that investing in women is investing in peace as well, right? So this is common sense, great stuff, not without its implementation challenges. But personally, I think it'd be an absolutely missed opportunity for the US not to be thinking carefully, and maybe not in year one, but thinking carefully about how it brings its diplomatic might to the table in subtle ways, messaging from ambassadors, discussions in the hotel lobbies of Port Moresby with American businesses. At some point, we have to crack the conversation around corruption in Papua New Guinea. And that shouldn't be the job of one donor alone. That should be the job of donors working in concert with amazing civil society leaders in Papua New Guinea who really care about this and want a different future of their country. And they don't want it off the back of an aid program. They want it off the back of a really accountable government. And I think that would be a really exciting development.
Yeah, I mean, that that corruption figure you mentioned is really, really quite staggering. But there's a really hopeful message there, I suppose, to achieve a really effective coordinated approach if our Australia, United States, and perhaps other countries can work together in a strategic fashion to kind of prioritise and triage our efforts accordingly. I mean, from observing, obviously it's still very early days in the introduction of this new global fragility approach, but to both of you, I mean, are you observing that there is a sufficient degree of kind of strategic focus and coordination between countries in their approach to PNG? Because it strikes me that if I'm a government official sitting in a Papua New Guinean department and I'm getting multiple different approaches from different governments on different issues, that could perhaps overwhelm the capacity of my system to actually take advantage of the various initiatives that are being put forward.
I could talk forever on US-Australian cooperation. No, on a more serious note, I think you got to start exactly with that will, right? How is a Papua New Guinean leader who is invited to 24 workshops from 27 different donors every week going to handle the US coming into town, right? And how is the US going to handle coming into town when the US modus operandi is generally in these sorts of situations where they are the dominant presence. They're established on the ground. They know who's who in the zoo, where to go, who to contact to get stuff done, right? That's not going to be the experience of the United States as they increase their presence in Port Moresby. So naturally enough, and I think it's common sense for Papua New Guinea, it's common sense for DC and Canberra planners to be thinking already about US-Australian cooperation. And we actually saw an MOU signed between USAID and the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade in Canberra a year or two ago now, articulating exactly that there was benefits in US and Australia working out how to work in these environments, particularly in the Indo-Pacific, right? So it's definitely on the radar. And I think being here already in DC, Errol and his team are doing amazing work along with the Australian Embassy to convene a bunch of discussions here, right? But what we know about cooperation is that you can have all the strategic plans in the world and all the great commitments in DC and Canberra and Port Moresby, but the ones that really matter are the Port Moresby connections. So it's the people on the ground discussing, you know, who is funding what, who is approaching who, engaging with their Papua New Guinean counterparts as well. So I think there are going to be major challenges, but back to Errol's point, you know, we're not talking massive bickies to start here. I think that it's not going to be a significant problem immediately, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on. And I think that the US and Australia offer each other something on this. Australia has extensive Pacific expertise that just does not exist within the USAID infrastructure at the moment. That is really important. But Australia also offers a really, really important set of networks and a slightly more subtle approach, right? And I think that that's exciting for the US to take up. And from what I've seen, the US is quite open to doing so. Whether it works on the ground all the time, we all play nice, is up for grabs. But what's your take, Errol?
Look, I'm going to break out the popcorn here and watch how this plays out, I think, because this is going to be fascinating. The US, like I think Will, you said, and Bridie, you've mentioned, the US is used to going into a country and being there for years and doing everything for everyone everywhere, or at least trying. And that's just not going to be the case here. And I sense some excitement in my US government friends who are responsible for the implementation of this, in that idea that we're not the biggest game in town. In fact, we're not even in the top two or three, probably. Not just in terms of the money, but I mean, we're building an embassy there. I mean, we have a regional diplomatic presence, and I think we are not the biggest game in town. In fact, we're really not even a game in town right now. And I think that's going to be fascinating to see how we play, not just in the interagency Department of Defense, State Department, USAID sandbox, but actually in this, you know, with our bilateral partners, the Australians, the Kiwis, the, you know, Japanese, with the multilaterals. There's a lot of lip service in this global fragility conversation here in Washington about leveraging and partnering with those friends and allies and partners. And I think more so than any of these other places that we've, you know, mentioned in terms of these initial focus areas for the Global Fragility Act, more so than any of those in Papua New Guinea, that's going to have to be the case. So far, the messaging is right, and that excitement, I think, that people feel is palpable. You know, there was a senior U.S. government delegation that went to Port Moresby and stopped in Canberra on the way home. I think these are positive signals that they're receiving these messages. The proof will be in the pudding in terms of when they actually start programming, whether we're able to and interested in doing joint funding or pooled funding on projects, or whether we're actually willing to kind of come to the table with that anti-money laundering, you know, stuff and capabilities that Bridie talked about. Cautiously optimistic, but this is certainly something new for the United States.
It's probably worth just making mention that, you know, Errol and I have been sitting here poring over the fragility strategy, excitingly discussing potential in Papua New Guinea. But, you know, I've just come out of Canberra and no one's talking about this, right? This was an announcement that was made a couple of months ago. It was in the pipeline previously, even where Washington was captured when this Global Fragility Strategy passed and the Global Fragility Act passed as well. It just did not hit a single radar that I saw in Canberra. So maybe there's also a question here around not just whether or not the US can play nicely as the smaller game in town, but whether or not Australia is going to lean into this as well. And I think that remains to be seen. The US is coming with a very different lens, like I was saying, on fragility, conflict prevention. This is not a big thing in Australia. And I don't know how highly this work will rate on the Australian government agenda.
Bridie, I love that I fooled you into thinking that Washington, D.C. is super excited about fragility and conflict prevention. I think
maybe
I think
you all, and I.
Yeah. I mean, I've sort of been on the periphery of this peace building advocacy world for years, and you know, at times felt like I was screaming into a void. And so now we have a thing that we can hold on to. And so that I think there's excitement. It's not necessarily that super tanker hasn't turned yet. We're still in the tugboat, you know, trying to make it work. But yes, I love that you think that there's all this momentum here in Washington, Brady.
Ask me again in 8 weeks.
Well, that's it. I suppose there's plenty of change and dynamism happening in both the American and Australian systems around these issues. So it'd be excellent to have you both perhaps join us in a little while to reflect and evaluate these things as they progress. But for the time being, thank you both for dialing in to join us late in the DC evening and to share your remarkable insights with our audience. So thank you both.
Thanks, Will.
Thanks, Will.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.